This is podcast number 151 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and I'd like to share the story today of Marie Antoinette. Until recent years, the only thing I knew about Marie Antoinette is that she lost her head after telling starving peasants, "Let them eat cake." I viewed her as frivolous, extravagant, and clueless. But like everything else, the more I dig, the more I find out how much I don't know and how distorted and incomplete my views are. Today I'm going to share a story from an 1892 book called Mothers of Great Men and Women by Laura Holloway that focuses on Marie Antoinette as a wife and a mother, where you may see her, as I did, through fresh eyes, which has caused me to look at her with new respect and compassion. I was going to say more about the spirit of the mobs at that time, how cruel they became, wondering if we are seeing a trend toward that in America today, but I'll save that conversation for another time. But I do want to call attention to just one more interesting little point, since we're also studying the American Revolution this month. I just hadn't made the connection myself before. When we sent over our statesmen to appeal to the King and Queen of France for help, we were appealing to this very young and newly crowned couple, Marie Antoinette and her husband, Louis XVI. Their story is intertwined with ours. Now the story. Marie Antoinette as wife and mother. The world has never seen and never can see a sadder and more pathetic biography than that of Marie Antoinette. Here is a woman supported through such experiences as make the least emotional of us shudder even now to think of, and we wonder how she retained her reason and her trust in God. In other tragedies, there is an interlude of light and hope. In this one, there is none. From the discovery and arrest of the fugitive royal family at Varennes to the scaffold that faced the gardens of the Tuileries, there is no respite, no relief, no ray of hope, no parenthesis of pity. From palace to prison, from prison to dungeon, from the Tuileries to the temple, from the temple to the conciergerie, from the conciergerie to the common felon's prison and the guillotine. This is the cumulative story of the royal victim. These the steps of the ladder that bore her heroic footsteps from earth to heaven. Marie Antoinette Joseph Jeanne was the youngest daughter of Francis, eventually the emperor of Germany, and of Maria Theresa, more generally known as the Empress Queen, who bore 16 children. She was born on the 2nd of November, 1755. Her parents preferred greatly to their gorgeous palace at Vienna, a smaller one which they possessed in the neighborhood where they could cultivate rural and domestic tastes and bring up their children healthily. In this quiet home, Marie Antoinette passed a happy childhood. Her beauty, intelligence, and affectionate disposition made her the favorite of her father, and the first sorrow she ever knew was at his death, which occurred in 1765, before she was 10 years old. He was going to Innsbruck on some business, and his carriage was drawn up in the courtyard of his palace. Before starting, he asked for his little daughter, that he might kiss her goodbye. "Adieu, my darling child. Papa wished to press you once more to his heart," are the words ascribed to him. If so, they were prophetic, for he was seized with illness at Innsbruck, where he died, and they never saw each other again. The superintendence of her vast empire occupied a far larger share of his widow Maria Theresa's attention than the education of her children. But as Marie Antoinette grew in beauty and attractiveness, the Empress Queen, her mother, saw a prospect of cementing more closely her recent alliance with France by a marriage between Marie Antoinette and the Dauphin of France, grandson of the reigning king, Louis XV. For this purpose, she made proficiency in French the chief aim in the young girl's education. Metastasis taught her Italian, and Gluck gave her lessons on the harpsichord. Marie Antoinette was perhaps too fond of play to apply steadily to her studies. At any rate, she herself regretted sincerely in afterlife her own want of literary information and culture, and endeavored to make up her deficiencies by taking lessons in more than one accomplishment during the first years of her residence at Versailles. She felt, when afterward queen, her inferiority in culture to the ladies of the old French noblesse, and once exclaimed sadly, "What a resource amid the casualties of life is a well-cultivated mind! One can then be one's own companion and find society in one's own thoughts." Such, then, was Marie Antoinette, when at the age of 15 she went to Paris and became the bride of the Dauphin, afterward Louis XVI. On the day which she set out from Vienna, her mother had written the following letter to her future son-in-law. "Your bride, my dear Dauphin, has just left me. I do hope that she will cause you happiness. I have brought her up with the design that she should do so, because I have for some time foreseen that she would share your destiny. I have inspired her with an eager desire to do her duty to you, with a tender attachment to your person, with a resolution to be attentive to think and do everything which may please you. I have also been most careful to enjoin upon her a tender devotion toward the master of all sovereigns, being thoroughly persuaded that we are but badly providing for the welfare of the nations which are entrusted to us when we fail in our duty to him who breaks scepters and overthrows thrones according to his pleasure. I say then to you, my dear Dauphin, as I say to my daughter, cultivate your duties toward God. Seek to cause the happiness of the people over whom you will reign. It will be too soon, come when it may. Love the king, your grandfather. Be humane to him. Be always accessible to the unfortunate. If you behave in this manner, it is impossible that happiness can fail to be your lot. My daughter will love you, I am certain, because I know her. But the more that I answer to you for her affection and for her anxiety to please you, the more earnestly do I entreat you to vow to her the most sincere attachment. Farewell, my dear Dauphin. May you be happy. I am bathed in tears." The earlier years of the married life of Marie Antoinette were frivolous rather than happy. Her husband treated her with respectful coldness, for his nature was not demonstrative of attention. He had no idea of wounding her feelings, but he did not see her society in private, and had no perception that marriage was to her, as a warm-hearted woman, anything more than the matter of convenience and acquiescence that it was to himself. Married at the early age of 14 years and a half, to a youth only a few years older than herself, the pair was childless for 8.5 years after their union. Louis XV died on the 10th of May, 1774, and the Dauphin and Dauphiness became King and Queen of France. There seemed little prospect of a family, and this disappointment was keenly felt by the Queen. Her natural desire for children of her own was greatly increased when her sister-in-law, the Countess d'Artois, presented her husband with a son. She treated the young mother with sisterly affection, but she could not restrain her feelings on the subject when writing to her mother, and she expressed candidly the extreme pain she suffered at thus seeing an heir to the throne who was not her own child. At a pavilion her husband had given her at her own request, about a mile from the Palace of Versailles, she sought to quench her grief in a constant whirl of pleasurable excitement. Little did the yearning but giddy young queen imagine that she was helping by her extravagance to bring on that revolution of which hatred to rank and wealth was the spark that was to consume herself and her husband and all her dearest friends. Her joy at the prospect of having a child was fully shared by her husband. All his coldness and apathy seemed to vanish, and he wrote himself both to her mother and her brother Joseph, the emperor. The news created equal joy at Paris and Vienna, and the poor young queen showed her grateful sense of happiness by liberal gifts to the poor and by founding a hospital for women in a similar condition as her own. On the 19th of December, 1778, she gave birth to a princess who was named Maria Theresa in honor of her imperial grandmother. She alone of the four children of Marie Antoinette lived to maturity in a good old age. "Boys will come after girls," wrote Maria Theresa to her daughter. The birth of the princess came near being the death of the queen. By the barbarous custom of that time in France, everyone, even the rabble, who could gain an entrance into the chamber was admitted to be witness of the royal birth. The heat was so intense that the queen became insensible and had to be bled in the foot. The king rushed to the windows and with all his strength got them open. His was the voice that whispered tenderly to her that she had been delivered of a daughter. She herself was not disappointed. When the nurse brought her the babe, she whispered, "Poor little thing, you are not what was desired, but you shall not be the less dear to me. A son would have belonged to the state. You will be my own. You shall have all my care. You shall share my happiness and sweeten my vexations." Besides the gifts to the poor and the hospital which were made before the birth, the happy mother now sent large sums of money to the prisons to release poor debtors, gave dowries to 100 poor maidens, applied to the chief officers of the army and navy to send her a list of veterans worthy of reward, and to the clergy of Paris for the names of worthy objects for her bounty. She also settled pensions on a number of poor children who were born on the same day as the princess, one of whom, who owed her education to this pension, became known to fame as Madame Mars, the greatest of comic actresses in Paris. In the spring of 1780, Marie Antoinette was shocked by the news of her mother's death. They had been much attached to each other since Marie became a queen and had corresponded regularly upon important subjects. Maria Theresa gave far more prudent advice to her daughter than did the haughty Catherine of Russia, who once wrote to her that kings and queens should do as they please and pursue their own plans regardless of the interest of their dogs of subjects. On the morning of October 2nd, 1782, a son and heir to the throne blessed the love of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. The king, whose affection for her had steadily grown in intensity since she began to have children, would not allow her life to be endangered this time by a crowd of strangers in their apartments. He forbade anyone but himself to announce to her the sex of the child, and it was with a heart full of joy and pride that he told her that their hopes of an heir were fulfilled. The child was not destined to live. The Dauphin, whose sad lot and early death from neglect and ill-treatment form one of the tragedies of that awful series, was Marie Antoinette's third child, not yet born. The elder son and second child was sickly and had spinal complaint from his birth. He had no stamina to support him through the ordinary ailments of children, and he died on June 4, 1789, when not yet 7 years old. On the 27th of March, 1785, the future desolate and slowly murdered Dauphin came into the world, which was for him a prison and a slaughterhouse, a habitation of cruelty and the grave of all his young affections. The reader of history thanks the justice of a crime-permitting providence that his keeper, Simon the Shoemaker, who starved him and beat him and kept him in filth and darkness for the last 3 years of his young life, was carried to the guillotine before the child victim's death. The princess, Sophie Helene Beatrix, was the fourth and last child of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. She was born on the 9th of July, 1786, was a sickly child, and died on the 9th of June, 1787, aged 11 months. We have Marie Antoinette before us at the beginning of the Revolution as the mother of two children only, the Princess Royal, now 9, and the Dauphin, 7 years old, the two others having died. She made it her happiness and her duty to study the dispositions of the young prince and princess. Her mind was bent on training her son not as a common child, but as one who was heir to the throne of a great and illustrious nation. In a letter to Madame de Tourzel, dated July 25, 1789, the mother writes, "I have always accustomed my children to have great confidence in me, and when they have done wrong, to tell me themselves. And then, when I scold them, this enables me to appear pained and afflicted at what they have done, rather than angry. My son cannot read, and he is very slow at learning, but he is too giddy to apply. He has no pride in his heart, and I'm very anxious that he should continue to feel so. Our children always learn soon enough what they are. He is very fond of his sister and has a good heart. Whenever anything gives him pleasure, whether it be going anywhere or that anyone gives him anything, his first movement always is to ask that his sister may have the same. He is light-hearted by nature. It is necessary for his health that he should be a great deal in the open air, and I think it is better to let him play and work in the garden on the terrace than to take him longer walks. The exercise which children take in running about and playing in the open air is much more healthy than forcing them to walk, which often makes their backs ache. The letter proves her to have been a good, a prudent, and a watchful mother. Poor little Louis! A far different fate awaited him from what she fondly hoped for. The Committee of Public Safety decreed that the young Capet, as they called him, should be placed in solitary confinement under the charge of the brutal shoemaker Simon, who had private orders to get rid of him by degrees. It was night when the officers of the committee came to carry him away. His mother flung her arms around him and resisted all efforts to tear him from her, exclaiming, "Tuez-moi donc d'abord, then kill me first." They only prevailed by threatening to kill the child, when she relaxed her hold and sank exhausted with the struggle. The unhappy dauphin was shut up for nearly 2 years before his merciful release by death, in solitude, without employment, without human sympathy or kindness, denied even the light and air. When the door was opened, it was to place a flagon of dirty water and a crust of bread for him. He was never washed, and his clothes and linen were never changed. It was a slow death in a living tomb. His limbs became rigid, his mind vacant and insensible. After his keeper was executed for his other crimes, his persecutors relented, but it was too late. The celebrated physician, Dursault, was sent to his lowly bedside. His mother's image, that mother from whom he had been so cruelly separated 2 years before, when she was doomed to the guillotine, but whom he was not perhaps to rejoin in everlasting reunion, was the last that filled his dying vision. The physician asked him if he suffered much. "Oh, yes, I suffer still," he answered, "but much less than I did. The music is so beautiful." "On what side do you hear this music?" "There, on high. Listen, listen." Then after a brief silence, his eyes kindled with the heavenly light, and he exclaimed with the rapture of an enfranchised and departing soul, "Amidst all the voices, I have recognized that of my mother." He waved his hand, wafted a kiss to her, and sank back dead. The opening of the year 1789 was the beginning of troubles for Marie Antoinette. Hitherto she had been alternately lauded and insulted by the artisans of Paris. Now the very refuse of humanity were to fling their dirt at her. Hers is one of those characters that are washed and made white by passing through great tribulation. All that was frivolous and extravagant in her conduct disappeared forever, and the heroic queen was only less admirable than the devoted wife and mother. The vilest slanders were circulated against the queen, one of them being that she had a mind ready to blow up the Parliament of Paris or National Assembly. On the 14th of July, the cry, "To the Bastille!" was echoed from mouth to mouth by a drunken mob along the banks of the Seine. This was the third day of the insurrection, and they stormed the iron and stone forms of the Bastille and murdered the governor and military that defended it, who had been taken by surprise and could make little resistance. At midnight, couriers arrived at Versailles to apprise the king and queen of the terrible aspect of affairs. On the 6th of October, 1789, when the mob insisted that she should make her appearance, she came forth on the balcony, holding the dauphin with one hand and the princess with the other. "No children," was the angry cry. She led them away and reappeared alone. Even the insensate crowd was astonished at her calmness and courage, and with true French fickleness, burst into rounds of applause. On the night of the 13th of April, 1790, the king, after vainly looking for her in her own apartments, found her in the Dauphin's nursery, holding him in her arms. "Madam," said Louis, "I have been looking for you everywhere, and you have caused me such uneasiness." "Sire," replied Marie Antoinette, "I am at my post." When Versailles was attacked, Louis tried to induce his wife to fly with the children, but she refused to leave her husband, declaring that her place was by his side, and that as a daughter of Maria Theresa of Austria, she had no fear of death. It was a sorrowful journey which the king, now accompanied by the queen and his children, took back to Paris. The procession was painfully slow, and as no food had been provided for the journey, the little dauphin cried from hunger. The good mother, who never shed a selfish tear, wept at the sufferings of her child. She begged him to be patient, and the little fellow ceased complaining. "Mama," he said, when they reached the Tuileries, which had been neglected and whose chambers were dismantled, "how bad everything looks here." "My boy," she replied, "Louis XIV lived here comfortably enough." It would be beside our purpose to stain our pages with the nameless and inhuman crimes of the reign of terror. Let us cling to the queen woman, true and noble to the last, who was soon to leave us. A little plot of ground was railed off in the garden of the Tuileries for the dauphin's amusement, and one of her favorite recreations was to watch him working at the flower beds with his little rake and hoe, although neither she nor he was left for a moment without the grenadiers of the city guard, who watched her as though she were a criminal already condemned. Privacy and rest were never to be hers again in this world. "The king," said Mirabeau, "has but one man about him, and that is his wife. More than one attempt was made to murder her. If my death only secures the throne to my son, I shall willingly die." Even in their imprisonment in the temple, they had at least for a time the consolation of each other's society and that of their children. But they were soon separated, and worse than the bitterness of death was the separation of the wife and mother, first from her husband, then from each of the children. On the 11th of December, 1792, the mock trial of the king took place. On the 21st of January, 1793, he met death like a man. Marie Antoinette, now a widow, still young, but with locks white as snow through sorrow, was removed to solitary imprisonment, and the last inhuman cruelty that can be inflicted on a mother fell upon her in the seizure of her darling son. Dearly did she love him, and when, while they were yet together, her friends proposed a plan of escape, she refused the offer and wrote, "The interest of my son is my sole guide, and whatever happiness I might find in being out of this place, I cannot consent to separate myself from him. I could enjoy nothing if I were to leave my children." And when on the night of the 3rd of July, the little king was sleeping, and as we have already told, was snatched from her embrace, the last words which the unhappy child of misfortune was ever to hear on earth from his poor mother's lips were these: "My child, they are taking you from me. Never forget the mother who loves you tenderly, and never forget God. Be good, gentle, and honest, and your father will look down on you from heaven and bless you." To the Princess Elizabeth, her true sister in affliction, and who was soon to share the same fate, she wrote from the common prison in which she was herded with the lowest felons her last letter, dated October 16th, 4:30 a.m., in which she said, "It is to you, my sister, that I write for the last time. I have just been condemned, not to a shameful death, for such is only for criminals, but to go and rejoin your brother. Innocent like him, I hope to show the same firmness in my last moments. I am calm as one is when one's conscience reproaches one with nothing. I feel profound sorrow in leaving my poor children. You know that I only live for them and for you, my good and tender sister. You who out of love have sacrificed everything to be with us, in what a position do I leave you? I have learned from the proceedings at my trial that my daughter was separated from you. Alas, poor child, I do not venture to write to her. She would not receive my letter. I do not even know whether this will reach you. Do you receive my blessing for both of them? I hope that one day when they are older, they may be able to rejoin you and to enjoy to the full your tender care. Let them both think of the lessons which I have never ceased to impress upon them, that the principles and the exact performance of their duties are the chief foundation of life, and then mutual affection and confidence in one another will constitute its happiness. Let my daughter feel that at her age, she ought always to aid her brother by the advice which her greater experience and her affection may inspire her to give him. And let my son, in his turn, render to his sister all the care and all the services which affection can inspire. Let them, in short, both feel that, in whatever positions they may be placed, they will never be truly happy but through their union. Let them follow our example. In our own misfortunes, how much comfort has our affection for one another afforded us? And in times of happiness, we have enjoyed that doubly from being able to share it with a friend. And where can one find friends more tender and more united than in one's own family? Let my son never forget the last words of his father, which I repeat emphatically. Let him never seek to avenge our deaths. I have to speak of one thing, referring to the depositions which the captive little son had been compelled by his persecutors to sign, containing accusations against his aunt and his mother, which is very painful to my heart. I know how much pain the child must have caused you. Forgive him, dear sister. Think of his age and how easy it is to make a child say whatever one wishes, especially when he does not understand it. It will come to pass one day, I hope, that he will better feel the value of your kindness and of your tender affection for both of them. I beg pardon of all the vexations which, without intending it, I may have caused you. I pardon all my enemies, the evils they have done me. I bid farewell to my aunts and to all my brothers and sisters. I had friends. The idea of being forever separated from them and from all their troubles is one of the greatest sorrows that I suffer in dying. Let them at least know that to my latest moment I thought of them. Farewell, my good and tender sister. May this letter reach you. Think always of me. I embrace you with all my heart, as I do my poor, dear children. My God, how heart-rending it is to leave them forever. Farewell, farewell. Her apprehensions proved well-founded. The letter never reached her sister-in-law, but fell into the hands of Fauguier, who preserved it among his special papers. Had one spark of humanity survived in the monsters of the Reign of Terror, they would have respected the doomed prisoner's last wishes and last words. Those almost dying thoughts and anxieties, let it be remembered to her immortal honor, were not for herself, but for her children and her friends. It was dark when she began the letter, but now the faint beams of sunrise stole through the narrow window of her cell. She lay down on her straw bed and tried to sleep. At 7, the executioner came in. The streets were thronged by that Parisian mob whose faces, lurid with cruelty, were like a vision of pandemonium. She was used to their looks and their revilings and minded them no more. Other women and strong men also have gone stark, raving mad at 1/10 part of the sufferings this sublime woman endured. Yet the wounds were deep and had left their scars in the white hair and the wan, furrowed face, upon which still those lines of beauty lingered which had evoked the praises of Europe. A few weeks before her death, she struck her head against a door in following her jailer. Being asked if she was hurt, she answered, "No, nothing can hurt me now." An English lady saw her in her dungeon, for anyone who asked was allowed to look at her on the one condition of expressing no sympathy, and said in a letter, she was sitting on an old, worn-out chair made of straw, which scarcely supported her weight. Dressed in a gown which had once been white, her attitude bespoke the immensity of her grief. In a common cart, seated on a bare plank, the executioner by her side holding the cords with which her hands were already bound, she was borne to the place of execution. Her last words showed the true lady and the queen. In descending from the cart, she had stepped on the executioner's foot. "Excuse me, sir," she said. "I did not do it on purpose." And she added, "Please make haste." In a few moments, all was over. So perished by a death which, as she nobly said, was to her not ignominious, because she was no criminal, one of the very noblest wives and mothers. She had never injured or borne malice against a single human being. Benevolence was native to her soul, and her charities were only bounded by her means. She had those virtues of purity, fidelity, courage, and affection which exalt humanity and redeem our fallen race. She was an angel whom accident had put under the power of devils. If families are reunited in a brighter world than this, there is no reunion that heavenly spirits would more gladly gaze upon than that of these poor Capets, King and Queen of France. One more victim from that family was still to follow her, the saintly, meek, and self-sacrificing aunt. Madame Elizabeth, as the king's sister was called since titles had been done away, committed the orphan children to God's holy keeping and went calmly from those who, in the words of Socrates, falsely call themselves judges upon earth to the presence of eternal justice. Her life and character are a study worthy of a volume by itself. How little does the world appreciate the quiet life, service of such an aunt and mother as the Princess Elizabeth had proved herself to her brother Louis and his wife and children. Young and beautiful, she had chosen to share their sorrows when she might have wedded nobly or passed a brilliant life in the court of her older brothers, two of whom were in turn emperors. At Vienna, the reign of terror could not have made her a victim and a martyr, but she was one of those sweet women of whom, let us thank God, there are still many in a selfish world who have no thought of self, who forego all thoughts of marrying and giving in marriage to tend a brother's or a sister's little ones, and who resemble in this our blessed Savior, who came not to be ministered to, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many.